Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Coding 101 is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Coding 101 is brought to you by Lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit Lynda.com/C101. That's LYNDA.com/C101. And by DigitalOcean. Simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com. And once you sign up, be sure to enter the promo code C101 in the billing section for a $10 credit. Today on Coding 101, we've got a wild card episode with Adam Bertram. Hello and welcome to Coding 101. It's the TWiT show where we let you into the wonderful world of the code monkey / code warrior. I am Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, and joining me as always is my super special secret King Kamehameha mega good all-around guy, great hair co-host, Mr. Lou Maresca, a lead from Microsoft. Lou, thank you for coming back to Coding 101.
Thanks for having me, Padre.
I thought we should start expanding your title again because we got lazy there for a few weeks.
Yeah. You know what? We should start putting it down in my lower third for every week so we understand what it is.
Absolutely. Now, we do have a wild card episode. Now, our regular audience knows what this is. It's when we step back from the coding. We step back from the programming. We're playing a little bit with PowerShell and a mini module. And we speak to the people who are actually doing what we are teaching. The people who are in their daily lives programming, coming up with solutions that we talk about in Coding 101. Now, we've got a special guest today because this has not happened before. You may remember we had Sarah on our show not too long ago when she did her wildcard episode. And during the module, we had a man in the chat room who was incredibly knowledgeable about PowerShell, who also turned out to be an MVP, who also had incredible insights. So we invited him onto the show. Now, we're going to be getting to Adam in just a bit. But Lou, before we do that, I want to talk about brain cells.
Absolutely. Let's go.
Specifically, do you remember not too long ago, we covered a story talking about how IBM had been toying with neural computing. They had essentially duplicated a rat brain. Neural computing, when you start talking about electronics, is different than traditional electronics. Rather than having an if, then, if this, then that, then that, then that logic tree, neural computing allowed you to sort of mimic the patterns of neurons in the brain so that you could have associations rather than just memory recalls. Very interesting technology, very interesting science. But Lou, at the time, there weren't some really great applications. I mean, the applications they came up with was you could come up with computers that were very fast, that maybe could do pattern recognition a bit more easily than traditional computing, that maybe used less power for mobile processors. But there wasn't a really good use of this outside of the lab. Do you remember the story?
I think one of the biggest things was the fact that neurons are just super efficient in your brain. You know, power consumption wise, as well as just efficiency and how they actually fire. And so to have some kind of a transistor silicon based processor to be able to do the same, at this point in time, just wasn't possible. So even some of the older models, even the older versions of these processors that were supposed to simulate neurosynaptic firing, they're just so inefficient. So that's kind of the key.
Very inefficient. And also, you know, when you think about the way that the human brain works, the left brain is the logical brain. That actually operates more like a traditional computer, whereas the right brain, it's free to find patterns. So for example, if you recognize something, if you look at something and you say, oh, well, I've got a memory of that, you bring back all the associations that you have with that memory, with that thing that you are seeing or smelling or touching or invoking any of your senses. Now, that's the way that the human brain works, which is interesting that you can duplicate that in hardware. IBM's attempt at creating a rat brain was interesting, but they had created one with 48 million neutrons, whereas the human brain can contain billions of billions of neutrons. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a long way to go. But along with the hardware came a real-world application of software. What could you do to take advantage of that greater pattern recognition? Well, Lou, now we've got an answer, because some researchers over at the Singapore Agency for Science, Technology, and Research have created a robot that uses neural algorithms in order to navigate a robot more like a human would. What do you see as the challenges of coming up with that kind of device?
I mean, for one thing, you have to be able to, it's almost like a distributed computing system that has zero latency in between all the nodes, right? So it's, the idea here is to be able to process things all at once and to be able to stop processing other things, like you said, making decisions based off of spur of the moment things. So the whole idea of just having the substrate be able to have low latency calculations and be able to change the way each core does things, like neuron firing, is a super challenge in itself. And then, of course, power consumption and scaling down the processor to the right size. I mean, there's are tons of challenges coming into play when it comes to this type of a device.
Right. And specifically for our audience, when you start talking about neural networking, neural computing, neural clustering, it's going to require an entirely different paradigm of programming, of computer science. We don't have that yet. We're following a very set, very, I'm going to say not old, but traditional way of programming a computer that follows a logic tree. For example, today, if I wanted to create a robot that would go from point A to point B, what I would probably do is I would pre-program a course, and then I would set the robot to use sensors that it may have, visual sensors, maybe GPS, whatever I may have available to me, to correct its real-world position according to what it has in its pre-programmed path. Well, that works, and we've had some pretty good luck with that. But the problem with an approach like that, it's not very fault-tolerant. If you get far enough off of course, or if you cannot correct for deviances in the real world, your navigation just won't work. What the researchers in Singapore have done is they have taken the two types of brain cells that humans have for location, and they've tried to mirror it in software. Now, in our brains, we have two brain cells, two sets of brain cells that help us to find our place in the world. One is called a place cell, and the other is called a grid cell. Now, a place cell that's the pattern recognition. So it senses what environment we are just by looking around and saying, oh, I've been here before. Now, there's also the grid cell, and the grid cell is really, really good at doing absolute coordinates. So, for example, if I drive from San Francisco, where I was, to Las Vegas, where I am right now, even though I may not have an exact map of what I did, I kind of understand, because I've been traveling for X amount of time at X amount of speed, that I should be this amount of distance away from where I started. You combine those two, and you have a very incredibly powerful way to find your location. These Singaporean researchers, what they've done is they've done the same thing. They've modeled that neural network inside of hardware, and they've given a robot the ability to not just see with its sensors where it might be, but also to have sort of that dead reckoning, that sense of directions that humans, at least some humans, not most of the humans in my family, have. So that it gives them a really good sense of where they are. Lou, what kind of new computer science are we going to have to come up with to make this work?
It's almost like a variance of functional programming, where you come up with an action and then you have to perform that action in the sense where you're functionally doing something, and then being able to do multiple things at once, right? And more functions at once, and then be able to control and make decisions based off of those. So I think it's almost a variance of functional programming.
Yeah, I can't wait to see how this gets turned into something larger. But one thing for sure, I welcome our robot overlords. Now, when we come back, it's time to bring in our wild card guest. We've got Adam Bertram. He was hanging out in our chat room, and we were so impressed by the knowledge that he exhibited with PowerShell that we asked him to come onto the show. But before we do that, let's take a moment to thank the first sponsor of this episode of Coding 101. Now, let me ask you, Lou, when you need to learn something new, or when you want a reference on knowledge that you may have already had, you want to go one place, right? I mean, you don't want to be jumping all over the internet, finding content of different qualities, of different densities, of maybe even different subject materials. You want a one-stop shop to be both a reference and a place of repository knowledge, don't you?
Absolutely, especially a trusted place to go, somewhere you can trust the information.
Yes. Very important. And thankfully, we've got just such a place for this episode of Coding 101, and it's lynda.com. Now, lynda.com is for the makers. It's for the doers. It's for the curious. It's for the people who want to improve themselves. It's a online learning platform that gives you not just skills that you want to learn, but references to skills that you already have. Oh, if you want to take better photos, if you want to sharpen your Excel skills, maybe you want to develop an app, learn a new programming language, lynda.com is there for you. If you wanted to build a mobile app, right now, Lynda just added a new course called Building a Note-Taking App for iOS 9 with Swift, which takes you through all the steps in developing an app for iOS 9. By the end of the course, you will have developed a fully functional and working app. And we know from this show that the best way to learn is by practice. They also have versions of that course for Android and Windows Phone. And if you're looking to learn a new programming language, then you're going to want to check out their Code Clinic. It's a multi-course series where lynda.com experts look at common code challenges and offer their solutions using C, C++, C#, Java, JavaScript, PHP, Python, R, Ruby, and Swift. Code Clinic is an excellent resource for both aspiring and experienced coders alike. Now, with a lynda.com membership, you can watch and learn from top experts who are passionate about teaching. You can stream thousands of video courses on demand and learn on your own schedule. You will be able to learn the way you want to learn, not the way that the tool wants you to learn. And learning at your pace has always been key to learning properly. The courses are structured so that you can watch them from start to finish or consume them in bite-sized pieces. And you can browse each course transcript to follow along or search for a specific answer to jump to that point. No more scanning through an entire video to find that 15 seconds that contains the answer to your problem. You can download these tutorials. You can have them on your iOS, your Android device, on your laptop, and your PC. I'm telling you, if you are a maker, a doer, a computer science person, a geek, or just someone who wants to know how the world works, you got to try lynda.com. Now, your lynda.com membership gives you unlimited access to training on hundreds of topics, all for one low flat rate. Whether you're looking to become an expert, you're passionate about a hobby, or you just want to learn something new, folks, I want you to visit lynda.com/C101. And sign up for your free 10-day trial. That's lynda.com, lynda.com/C101. And we thank lynda.com for their support of Coding 101. Folks, it's one of my favorite times on Coding 101. It's when we get to introduce our guest. And in this case, it's Mr. Adam Bertram. Adam, thank you for joining us on Coding 101.
Hello, nice to be here.
Oh, this is unique for us. We don't normally get this kind of experience where we have someone in the chat room who we say, wow, we want this person on. You had some great insight during Sarah's episodes, and we thought, hey, you know what? Let's get another MVP. So thank you for hanging out in our chat room.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
For the folks at home, we always have to establish your bona fides. So we know that you're a Microsoft MVP. We know that you've been doing programming for quite a long time. We know that you deal a lot with automation using PowerShell. Could you tell us a little bit about what it is that you do on a daily basis? How do you interact with programming as part of your everyday life?
Well, my background is a little bit different than probably your traditional guest. Is I really don't consider myself a programmer or a developer, really. I've been in the operations role for many, many years, and I've been an IT pro for a really long time. It wasn't until recently, within the past few years, that my job has kind of transitioned me into more of a development role. So I started out with VBScript and scripting, and then went into PowerShell. And eventually, what an IT pro will find is once they start trying to automate more and more things of their daily tasks, eventually turn out to be you start to do everything more in code. So it's more the infrastructure as code is the buzzword now. So that's kind of what I do. But nowadays, what I do is I'm an independent consultant. I have a few contracts where I do mostly just all PowerShell work. I do a lot of training through sites like Pluralsight and Udemy, and I do a lot of blogging. So, but for the most part, it's all PowerShell all the time for me in this day and age.
Oh, it's interesting because we actually had an episode not too long ago. I think you would have felt right at home, and where we spoke with a couple of just contract programmers, some giggers, people who had jumped from position to position. Lou was one of them. Patrick Delahanty was one of them. I was one of them. It's an interesting economy. People who don't see themselves doing the same job, the same position over and over and over for the next 50 years, but are okay with moving from challenge to challenge to challenge. It sounds like you're more part of that gig economy than the traditional salaried worker.
Yeah, I've always considered myself an entrepreneur at heart. I've had full-time gigs for a long time, but only between the past year or so, I decided to pursue my passion full-time. And I always really considered myself an entrepreneur, but I never was able to have the courage to actually get out there and do something about it. That is until recently. I consider myself unemployable because I don't like reporting to anybody. And I really don't like following the rules very much. So generally, when I was employed, I was highly regarded. I was good at my job, but the manager would typically just put up with me. He's like, "Yeah, Adam has got his own opinion, so just let him do his own thing off in the corner, and be done with it." But so because I really wasn't truly happy until I started working for myself.
I love that you consider yourself unemployable. That's a very interesting take for a contract worker. Lou, the strange thing is I've actually heard that phrase before. My sister, she does contract work here in Las Vegas for Zappos. She finds them their tech people, and she's always told me that's a very interesting balance between finding someone who wants to work in an office and finding someone who has sort of the free spirited imaginative work that they really want out of their programming team. Do you find that a lot at DevWork in Microsoft?
Yeah, I think that it happens a lot. Like, people really just want to be in their bubble and they want to get their job done. They want to be able to, reach out and just for information, that kind of thing. And they find sometimes that even any type of office politics or even just communication when it comes to like messaging and email and all this stuff, just too much of a distraction. So they like to work in their own area and their own bubbles. And I think that's the key. Sometimes even as a self-employed person, you are kind of driven by your productivity. And there's a lot of people like that. But again, some people adhere to the model and some people just want to go and do their own thing.
So Adam, yeah. Am I hearing you right in that that bubble's not for you? You don't just want to get your head down and get the work done. You kind of actually want to be enjoying what you're doing.
Yes. If I'm going to do something, I want to enjoy it. I'm not just going to crank out the hours day after day. I have there's a saying, I'm not going to trade hours for dollars. I want to trade. I don't want to trade time for dollars. So I've always, for years and years, tried to find areas of places where I can help people do training and really just evangelize what I'm passionate about and to make some money versus like passive income and things like that. So I've built a few apps here and there that have maybe some passive income off and on. But yeah, I really like that model a lot better. I hate having a strict here. You have to work 40 hours a week or more, and you get paid X number of dollars for, whatever hours you're working. I don't adhere to that at all. So, but luckily I've had some good success with, what I'm doing now with training around PowerShell. So, so far so good. Let's hope I can continue.
Not trading for hours for dollars. I'm very impressed with that. Now let's get back to that, because first I want to jump, as we do with all of our interviewees, into your childhood. What's your earliest memory? I'm just kidding. No, we're not going that far back. But but where did you grow up, and where did you come into electronics, into technology, into computer science?
Yep. I grew up in a little bitty town in southern Indiana, Winslow, Indiana, which it was about, 800 people or so. And to think about where I came from and the culture that I came from and to be doing what I'm doing now, it's a stretch. You would have no idea how I would come out of something like that. So I was a country boy my whole life growing up until I was 18, until I went out of went to college here in Indiana. But really, my pretty normal childhood, other than my parents were just really supportive and was really tolerating of what I would do. I was the type of kid that would got a a 386 or something. It was an old PC at the time, and I would constantly break it. And we'd have a local guy come around and charge you 20 or 30 bucks or something to come over to fix it for some side income. I would look over his shoulder all the time and like, "What are you doing?" I just bugged the crap out of him because I would constantly, how do you fix that? How do you fix that? And that eventually he did that enough times there where my parents were tolerating enough for me to break their computer constantly. One of the PCs was my mom's business computer, but they realized that in order to learn, I was loving what I was doing. I really enjoyed computers, and luckily they tolerated me enough to be able to learn about it. Eventually, we didn't need the guy to come around. I would just break it and fix it myself. So that's kind of where I got my start.
I want to throw something from that at our chat room, because you said that you're from Winslow, Indiana, and that's not typically where you would imagine someone who would get involved in computer science and technology would come from. And I see that my generation would absolutely believe that. I mean, technology comes from the coast. It comes from maybe from New York, if you're talking about some technology that's combined with finance or design, and definitely from the West Coast. But I'm wondering, in today's generation, the generation that our chat room is from, we've got Creamy Corncob making a joke saying that, you shouldn't have been told to go fix a computer. You should have been told to go feed the pigs and fix the tractor. But does that still hold? Does this generation think that there are certain parts of the country that are good at technology? Or is it now we live in such an internet generation that you can pull talent from anywhere? Lou, what's your take on that?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that Microsoft started doing is going to schools in the Midwest, because there's actually a ton of engineering schools that are really, really great. But again, they're just for small populations. Like, for instance, there's a school in South Dakota called the School of Mines and Technology, and they have an amazing mathematics and computer science program. And some of the guys that have worked with or people that work with out of that school are just so impressive. But you would never think to go to South Dakota to look for math and science majors and computer science people. So I think that's a huge thing that we have to get over, a hurdle that we have to get over, that not just looking to the coast and to some of the big schools, to some of the smaller schools for some really talented people, because you're going to find people that are of a higher echelon.
And actually, Curtis B in the chat room is making a good point here. He's saying, look, a lot of farmers today use computers, GPS, automated combines. So, maybe this is not so unusual anymore. Adam, what do you think about that? I mean, anytime you give a community a chance to have a few individuals get recognized for technical skills where previously they had not been recognized, you develop a community, right? You develop an IT community.
I agree. I mean, nowadays that, we have everything is online, and I've been working myself remotely for years now. And it's one of the other topics that I'm passionate about, other than PowerShell, is telecommuting and remote work and finding talent other than not just your local business. It's a big pet peeve of mine when a business says, well, we can't find any talent. And then when I was looking for a job, I would say, well, I'm available to work remotely. And they say, well, no, we're only looking for somebody locally. They won't even consider you if you're remote. And I think that's crazy. And nowadays they're missing out on so many talented people. And, not only in the job market, but as you mentioned, a community. I didn't know anybody, and nobody knew me, just even a year or two ago. And now that I'm able to actually get out there and share my knowledge with the community and share the things that I know and do the training and the blog posts and being on Twitter probably too much, it's really rewarding to see that, all that knowledge that I've gathered over the 17, 18 plus years that I've been in this industry, that you can finally give back and really make some really good connections with people in the community.
So, Adam, since you gave us your origins, that actually didn't include computers, and then you kind of tinkered with them as you got into your teens, where was that transition from, for me, it was a little different where, I was more into electronics and electrical engineering, and then I kind of transitioned into software. Where was your transition? Where did you learn your programming craft? And what languages did you start with?
Well, I've really, since I was 4 years old, I think my mom has a picture of me on the computer when I was four, when I was starting to mess with it. I mean, I was never actually into programming, actually building applications, but I was always really interested in technology. I was one of those geeks in elementary school and middle school that I was messing with my autoexec.bat to make these crazy menus and stuff whenever I would bring up the, the computer. Well, would you like to boot with Stackeron, or would you like to boot with, this sort of thing? I would mess with these batch files. So I've been messing with batch files nearly my entire life. And really, Ever since I was a young child, I would write, you know, batch files, and eventually it was just, then I graduated into VBScript whenever it came out during my career, and then eventually PowerShell. I also dabbled a little bit in PHP. I was a web developer, pseudo kind of web developer for a while, so I did a lot of WordPress work also.
And what did you find you used more? You said you kind of dabbled in VBScript and Power and PHP. What did you find you did more? What kind of other languages did you kind of do? And how did they apply to your jobs? Were they kind of linked to your jobs? That's why you learned more, or you just kind of did it on your own?
Well, really, the majority of the programming knowledge that I have, none of it was with my job. You know, I've been a system administrator for my entire career, and it wasn't until VBScript and definitely PowerShell that I'm sort of seeing myself transition from a traditional system administrator to I consider myself a coder, I guess, now. But, you know, now with all the DevOps movement, I'm now in charge of, here, you need to write this script, and the script is not a script anymore. It's a script. Some of the scripts that I write are thousands of lines long. It's more of a software project now. And now I'm getting to the point to where just now I'm trying to learn different methodologies and, learn, okay, here's Agile and here's Waterfall. This is all pretty new to me. So I'm pretty new. I considered to switch from a traditional ops role into a C# developer, because I do some C# now, especially with PowerShell. There's times you have to drop down into C#. But what I found was, since I have 18 something years experience in IT, but I have maybe a year or two in traditional software development. And what I found was, when I would look for a job as a traditional software developer, I would come in at the base rate, and like, it was just a culture shock, because like, you want to say, I've been in this space, the technology space, for so long, but literally, no, you don't have quite the experience that you did. Obviously, you're not a developer. You've been in IT for so long. So it was kind of a culture shock.
Adam, I want to talk a little bit about this. You said you're a coder. And I know where that comes from, because for a very, very long time, scripting wasn't really considered coding. Or if it was, it was sort of the lowest form of coding. It was akin to programming in HTML. Which, again, some people don't consider programming. And that came along for a long time, because the coders, the actual programmers, the code warriors, were the people who could come up with problems, come up with solutions to those problems broken down into codable pieces, and then write in a language like C# or C++. Actually, it would be C++ back then. Scripting has really gained prominence recently because of IT automation. I think that's where it has grown. Where have you seen scripting sort of infiltrate IT more and more? Because so many of the tasks that we used to have to do on a daily basis as system administrators, we now depend on pretty complicated scripting to take care of for us.
I agree. I mean, it really, as far as the Windows world is concerned, it was just PowerShell, PowerShell, PowerShell now. I mean, since PowerShell essentially rides right on top of the .NET framework, and you can use anything in .NET that you can use, and just straight .NET, you can use that all in PowerShell now. And what you're seeing now is part of this movement, the DevOps movement, to where developers and ops are starting to come together to say, well, let's stop being on separate teams, and let's be on the same team now. Well, now we have PowerShell. What I found is it came from the ops world. It was generally created to better manage and to better automate IT. But what you're seeing now is, since it's so robust and it's so powerful, since it does ride on top of the .NET framework, that you see developers also using it to do code deployments, to do just general things to fix various pieces of the infrastructure. Then you're seeing that the ops guys using it as well. So PowerShell itself is kind of the something that's brought us together to say, well, you know what, let's just work together for the common goal of just getting code out the door. Well, the ops guys, you're now coding in PowerShell. Well, developers, you're coding in C++ or C# or .NET or whatever you want. So I mean, I really love, that's where I'm kind of in the middle now. I've been scripting for so long that, I've kind of forgotten my traditional click, click, next GUI admin roots, where I pretty much, when I want to do something in the ops world, it's generally in PowerShell and I'll just automate it. So I'm kind of on that line to where I'm sort of the ops guy. And then I'm now starting to kind of lean over to the development side quite a bit.
Yeah, scripting has come a long way since AutoExec Bat. But then that leads to a question that we got from the chat room from Web7424, who is asking, what do you use to document your scripts? I mean, as scripts, as you mentioned, have become thousands, tens of thousands of lines of code, we can't just rely on it to be one person's project anymore. So what do you prefer to use?
Well, I use a number of different methods. I'll give you an example of the client that I'm working for now. I mean, we have about, it's like 40 or 50,000 lines of code in just straight PowerShell. It's just all PowerShell code. And whenever I say that to somebody, they think, that big PowerShell, why? Well, we're using it as a framework to bring, to spin up new VMs, to deploy a SQL Server here. We now no longer can have to put the CDN, go through the next sort of thing with like a SQL Server. We can just say new SQL Server in PowerShell and it's out the door. But as far as keeping track of all this stuff, and on this client, we're using TFS. So we use source control just like the big boy developers do. We're using that in PowerShell, which you'll see a lot of PowerShell guys and gals use source control now, because like you said, we have to get that in there because the code is getting so much that, I use TFS at that client. I use Git and GitHub extensively for a lot of this stuff. So I follow lots of the traditional coding practices and the tools of the trade like a developer, but I don't know if I'd really ever consider myself a full developer.
So Adam, before PowerShell, what did you use to automate tasks? Like what's the advantage of using PowerShell instead now? Like you said, I know you said the full power of .NET, but is there anything else that you think that's beneficial comparably to using some of the older scripting languages?
No, I mean, I can only talk from the Windows world. I only have limited experience with Python and Bash scripting and all of that in the Linux world. But as far as the Windows world, yeah, I did VB scripts extensively. I was one of the geeks that got so hardcore in the VB scripts that I actually tried to create classes out of VB script, and it was ugly. It was extremely ugly. But I was so passionate about scripting that I was that much into VB script, and it was painful. But eventually I had such a big code base of my personal that I could just pull out a function here and there that I didn't have to worry about all that obscure syntax that you had to do. But once PowerShell came around, it was all over with. I never looked back from VB script. It's so easy. It has support for so many things that once took 20, 30, 40 plus lines of code in VB script. Now you can maybe do in 5 in PowerShell. It just makes things so much easier to do and to manage.
I want to talk a little bit about that scripting process, because we've talked pretty extensively here on Coding 101 on, well, what is the tree, the logic tree that we use when we decide to program something? Specifically, we had Mark Smith on not too long ago showing us an Arduino project in which he took a real-world problem, broke it down into its component parts, and then came up with code to answer each problem, each part. When you're doing scripting, what process do you use? Is it the same process, or specifically when you're dealing with IT processes, are you always looking at, this is how much code I should use, this is a task I need to automate, this is a task I don't need to automate? How do you decide what gets scripted?
Well, you have to go with traditional automation techniques. Well, first of all, am I doing this thing over and over and over again? In the IT world, let's say you're gonna spin up VMs like crazy. So, I want a process. Once you define your problem and something that you can automate that you're gonna do over and over and over again, you say, number one, I need to spin up a VM with this, and this configuration items on. I need these register keys to be in this spot. I need these files to be over here. You know, I need this application installed. It's just breaking down that problem just like you would in that Arduino project. So you start off with a problem, you break it down into, I need to install this application. Okay, well then, to install that application, how do I do that? Well, okay, you go to, here's the installer that you run. Okay, I need to run this installer, check, that's one task. I need to do a log file, check, that's another task. I need to put in this registry key, check. It's generally just the same thing as far as a logic tree is concerned. You just take an overall problem or even a task that takes an extremely long time to do that you find yourself doing over and over and over again. You can just simply write a script or a combination of scripts and just say, I don't no longer have to do that anymore. I'm just going to hit my button or in my PowerShell case, just to, you know, type the command, boom, and it's done. Or even just put it in a scheduled task or something to make it happen over and over again without even any interaction.
So, Adam, one thing that is interesting is that last time we had Sarah on, she was talking about that the way she got involved with the MVP program was that she did a lot of blogging and posting and helping people, you know, especially around the different programming areas that she was in. And that's how kind of Microsoft caught their eye about, you know, what she was doing. How did you get involved with the MVP program, and then what kind of got you, you know, year over year kind of staying involved?
Well, I've to be honest with you, I kind of just stumbled into it. I didn't set out to, you know, be an MVP. I never set out to, you know, get any of the awards that I did get. All I did was set out to say, you know what, I have been doing this for an extremely long time now, and I have all this knowledge built up here, but I was one of those, you know, the forum leeches where I would just go in the forums and I had a problem and just figure out what somebody did I wouldn't even do a thank you. But now I decided, no, I'm far along enough in my career. I'm going to start sharing my knowledge. So I started the blog. I started Twitter. I have countless GitHub projects now that I work on that I contribute to. Eventually, once you start doing that and search engine will pick up your blog, you'll start getting communication back and forth. And on Twitter, people start to see that, you know, you're really contributing. You're contributing so much time outside of your normal job. As of 6 months ago, I had a full-time job as an IT pro, and I would do this after hours on the weekends because I was passionate about it. I really loved doing it. And eventually somebody just tweeted to me one day and said, hey, you're doing a really good job with the community. I nominated you for a Microsoft MVP. And I'm like, that's great. I wasn't expecting it. And then I got once I got nominated, I got chosen, and, you know, here I am. I was a PowerShell MVP, but I think we're called now Content and Data Center Management MVPs.
Now, the MVP program is still, it's a little mysterious to most people because there are a lot of people who don't do any programming or any work for Microsoft products, Microsoft ecosystems. But when you think about the MVP community, because I know there's going to be a big gathering in Redmond start of November, actually. So what, next week?
Mm-hmm. Next week, yeah.
Yeah. What's the experience of getting together in a group like that? Because I know you don't all do the same thing. Some of you are hardcore programmers. Some of you are IT folks. Some of you are, you know, what we would call the IT shrub, the dock worker, the guy who has to do all the scut work. What's the common denominator between Microsoft MVPs?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't know. I can't answer that because I'm fairly new. This is my first MVP summit that I'll go to, but I can tell you that I've been in the community for a year and a half now. And just the MVP community, what you'll find is if you see somebody with an MVP name, you'll know ultimately that they'll help you regardless of what it is. We all tend to have this desire and drive to help people for some reason. you don't know how much time I spent just on some coding problem, some PowerShell problem that somebody emailed me with. I'd spend 2 hours on like, okay, how do you do that? How do you fix this thing? I don't know. That's the kind of the commonality between, you know, your traditional developer or IT pro or something like that. We just really love to help people. And I'm looking forward to the summit since this will be my first one coming up.
We're speaking with Adam Bertram. He's telling us a little bit about what it means to be a Microsoft MVP, what it means to be a scripter, a person who, is only recently being recognized as an absolutely essential part of the IT community. Now, when we come back, I want to dive back into that. Adam, do you mind if we talk a little bit more about what it means to be an MVP and what it means for you to be part of a larger community, a community that helps each other, a community that goes over each other's code, each other's problems? Would you mind if we dive a bit deeper?
Sure.
All right. But before we do that, let's go ahead and thank the second sponsor of this episode of Coding 101. Now, when we develop our apps, when we develop our services, we always have to consider how we're going to deploy it. I mean, how do we get the word out? How do we get it out to the world? Not only that, how do we test it? Because we can't just test it in the lab. At some point, we're going to want to throw some real-world traffic at it to make sure that it's going to survive its brush with the real world. Now, the old way to do it was to maybe get some space in a colo, maybe buy your own server, maybe set up your own OS just the way that you want it and get your agreements with your ISP, probably a financial contractor or two, and then contract with someone to maintain your server so that it never falls into security disabuse. You could do all that still. I mean, that is perfectly fine if you like doing a lot of work for nothing, or you could do what we do at Twit and work with DigitalOcean. Now, DigitalOcean is based on droplets, the idea that you can take anything, any app, any service, anything that you need to run in the cloud and put it into a versatile container. It's flexible, it's reliable, and it's affordable. Now, these droplets are going to be your way to scale your service, your app, your program from just testing with 3 or 4 people to deployed around the world. DigitalOcean is built for developers, by developers, and it's used by over 400,000 of them, including me. You get to deploy and configure your droplets via a streamlined control panel or a simple API. You get to choose your OS, Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. They've got a one-click install that will quickly deploy apps like Django, Docker, Drupal, LAMP, GitLab, MediaWiki, Node.js, WordPress, Ghost, Magento, OwnCloud, Ruby on Rails, and more. All their servers are built on hex core machines with dedicated ECC memory and RAID SSD storage space, and their servers can have up to 20 CPUs, 64 gigabytes of memory, and 640 gigabytes of SSD storage space. It's highly scalable to meet the demands of your rapidly growing application or business, which means that it grows with you, not in spite of you. Now, they've got auto backups and snapshots, so they take care of all that scut work, the stuff that you don't want to do. They give you gigabit speeds with 99.9% uptime and a full-featured DNS management console so that you can manage your domains or even use dedicated IPs if you need them. You've got web console access with HTML5 plus SSH, SFTP, and KVM VNC for virtual desktops and an extremely active community. This, I cannot stress this enough. This sounds like a throwaway line, but this is important. Anytime you look at a provider who's going to be hosting your services, your app, you need to have an active community. They will be able to answer your questions much more quickly than any FAQ. They're the ones who have run through the exact problems, the exact same situations that you've done. And like Adam Bertram, they're ready to help. It's so easy to get started. You can have your SSD cloud server up in as little as 55 seconds. I don't know why you wouldn't at least give DigitalOcean a try. DigitalOcean has incredibly affordable and straightforward pricing with servers starting at just $5 per month. There's also hourly pricing available starting at less than a penny per hour. But we're going to make it so that you can get started today and deploy your own SSD cloud server for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com and create an account. And once you sign up, enter the code C101 in the billing section for a $10 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Coding 101. We're speaking with Microsoft MVP Adam Bertram. He's been telling us a little bit about what it means to be an MVP and what it means to want to help others. Now, Adam, we know that the tech community, the IT community, especially the coding community, is pretty supportive. We borrow work from each other. We borrow ideas from each other. That's sort of the foundation of what we do. But part of this MVP lifestyle that you mentioned is that you need to want to help other people. There's something about that just sounds a little strange. Tell me more about that philosophy.
Well, let me see if I can sum it up for you. It's really, I don't know what changed that where I came from to be You know, I consider myself the leech of the community. I would just take other people's code, take other people's scripts, and just take other people's solutions to problems for a while. But eventually what you'll find is that if you start contributing, start giving back, start posting up, creating projects on GitHub, for example, you'll see people download your stuff, and then not every once in a while you'll get a thank you note and say, listen, your code saved me so much time in the PowerShell world. I've gotten countless emails and tweets that say, you know, I was doing this process over and over and over again, and your code saved me so much time. I've been following you forever. I love the stuff that you do. And then every now and then you'll get a person that really hits home and says, you know, because of what you've taught me in your Pluralsight courses, in your trainings, in your just general communication that you're getting out there, I've decided to I've seen how bad my company is because they don't embrace automation. They don't get it. They're in the Stone Age, and I've decided to go on elsewhere and I got this much better job. Or even the companies that do get it, that they have these evangelists inside of these companies. There's a few guys that I'm thinking of right now that we call them the PowerShell evangelists in their company. They're not MVPs, but they're kind of known to be the PowerShell guy in their company. And what I'm finding is it's kind of the spider web effect. You create enough of these evangelists out there for whatever technology, whatever language that you're passionate about, when eventually that this web will form and you'll have PowerShell people or whatever technology that you're currently working on in these various companies. And then these guys then collaborate with me and other MVPs and other people in the community to kind of form this, I don't know, this kind of knowledge tree. I really like it because I've seen some email threads where somebody in a company, a junior admin in a company, had a problem, send it off to a senior admin in the company, which then send it off to the known PowerShell guy or, you know, the person in the company that's known the most. And if they don't know it, then they'll pass it on to me. Even if I don't know it, then I can have the MVP email list that includes Microsoft, the PowerShell team, other MVPs, and we'll kind of get it done regardless of how hard it is. And then I just pass it back on down. I really love seeing that chain of help that's kind of been created as part of the MVP program and as part of the IT community as a whole.
Adam, I want to go back to something that you said towards the start of that response, and that is you spend some time leeching from the community. And I think we all do the same thing. We've got Browell in the chat room right now, who is just starting in programming. I think he's probably been in one of our groups. His grammar sounds very, very familiar. But what would you say to somebody who is in that stage where it feels as if all they're doing is they're taking someone else's code, they're changing a couple of lines to make it specific to their installation, to their automation, and then passing it off as their own? It's very easy to get discouraged. It's very easy to start to think, I'm not actually doing anything. How long do you think it takes from someone to get from that leeching stage to, well, no, now they can actually write their own code. They can write their own scripts.
Well, do as I say, not as I do, I guess, because it took me about 16 years or so to actually have the courage to think, okay, well, my code is actually pretty good now. I feel comfortable with sharing it. So it takes a long, long time to get to the point to where you're comfortable enough to put yourself out there and to share. Like, you know, I would do whatever it would take to, you know, to get the job done. I would, you know, download scripts or code or whatever I needed to do from the internet to get things done. And, you know, I really didn't think any of it. And, you know, I still really don't for people to do that. But as you're just starting out, as you know, junior admins, junior developers, you will do that more and more and more. You're kind of just getting your feet wet. You're starting to get up, get your coding legs strong, and really, that's how you learn. You know, we all learn. Any of the greenhorns learn by looking at what other people are doing, looking at mentors and other people, that other senior developers and people like that. That you're definitely going to do that a whole lot more than what you do now. Versus maybe somebody in my position now, you eventually get to the point you do something for enough times where you don't really have to go out and look for things anymore. Every now and then I'll go out and look at a code snippet here and there, but in the PowerShell world, I'm not for sure how, you know, in a traditional software development world, but in the PowerShell world, you know, I can just grab a little snippet, maybe three or four lines of code to do this. I'll Google how to import a certificate, or how do I, you know, all these little things that, as far as a language is concerned, that I don't need to know, but I don't specifically know what support, like how do I manage this SAN, or how do I manage this thing with, you know, PowerShell modules and that sort of thing. But yes, if you're just starting out, I leech away. I did for a long, long time. And really that's how I've got to the point to where, I know, as much as I do about PowerShell, because I was stealing code for years and years from the other MVPs. And now that I finally am MVP, I kind of get onto them. I kind of like the idol, like, oh, I've been following you for, you know, for 3 years or something like that. You know, the kind of starstruck, and I'm excited for the summit to actually meet some of these guys that I've been following for a long, long time.
Lou, you're not going to be able to get over to the summit, right? Because the MVP program is completely separate.
No, I'm going to be there for CRM. So I'll be there, and especially at their social where they have food.
Free food.
Food. Actually, I think I wanted to try to make it over, but unfortunately, I don't think we can work out the logistics. It should be absolutely fantastic. Lou, what's your take on that? Because Adam gave a very, very good, passionate plea for listen and learn. Just, you know, just sit there until you have the competence, the confidence to continue on. Is that what you would suggest? I mean, it seems like good advice no matter what, but especially when you're starting to do something like PowerShell, where a lot of scripts you will just get off of GitHub and change slightly. It's a good way to not lose heart when you're starting off.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, there's an old saying, you can even generalize it and say that, you know, you surround yourself with good people, you're going to become, you know, good at what you do. I think that's the key, is when you're talking about, you know, I wouldn't say leeching in the sense you're just using people's, you know, well-developed applications, even code, and, you know, patterns that they're following, and you're learning yourself what the good patterns are, and, you know, what's good design and architecture, and then you're then applying that to solve other real-world problems. And I think that's a really great way to learn, because you learn by people's good and bad. And, you know, especially if you surround people around you that, you know, you listen to and you watch and you follow, people that are really good at doing something, you know, you learn what to do, especially when it comes to programming languages. There's just a lot of little, you know, edge cases that you might necessarily know about. Maybe there's a library that you didn't really know it could do something like that. And these people might help you kind of find these things and surface these things. And then you have like Adam was saying, you have aha moments where you're like, wow, you know, I think that I can really develop something that's even better and does even more. And then I'll share it myself. So I think that's a great way to learn. I totally believe in that model.
Speaking of aha moments, I just had one last night. I was looking over a bunch of code that I wrote way back when to automate some IT tools that I had. They would go out and they would ping me whenever a certain conditions were met in a Wireshark screen that was scanning all the traffic running through my externals. And as Adam mentioned, I pulled a lot of this code straight off of GitHub, changed it so that it would work with my tools, and that was it. It worked, so I left it alone. I went back over it last night, and I realized there was a huge chunk, like the entire middle section of code, that I didn't need. So I just removed it. But after I had done that and the tool was back up and working properly, I said, okay, so that's my next step of knowledge, to be able to know what I don't need, what I can pull out of someone else's code, because it doesn't really do anything useful because I've written this. I like Lou said, I love those aha moments.
I've had times whenever I would Google or Bing something whenever I'm trying to figure out a problem, and I see a script and then I download it and I break it open now and I'm like, this code is terrible. Who did this? This is just horror. Then I look at the author and like, oh, that was me 5 years ago.
Totally agree. I think that's one thing that you'll find that, you know, over time, I'll go back and look at things that I've written, and you know, after I didn't know design patterns back in the beginning, and you know, learning, oh wow, why did I do it that way? You know, now it's, I feel like just rewriting this and resubmitting it somewhere so people know at least that I've learned by my mistakes. But totally 100% agree with that. So now this is a point in time, like in the interview process, where we sometimes transition into the kind of the personal views. And so I wanted to talk to you about is what kind of nuggets of knowledge can you give to our group? And, you know, what kind of things have you learned and helped you learn over the years and learned some of the technologies that you've learned?
Yep. Well, as far as the nugget of knowledge that I can provide, like, you know, as you know, that I've said, I've been an IT pro for my entire career. And now that you'll see, I want to mention the D word again, the DevOps word. And one thing that I'm very passionate about that if I were to pass on to others is the just the general, you know, mindset shift of automation and DevOps and the feedback loop. And to get to DevOps is not just about developers and operations. It's generally a culture thing. It's about you know, embracing automation. Don't just you know, click next through an installer to do things. You know, virtualize, use the cloud, get more involved in things that are more dynamic. As in, you know, infrastructure as code is another one. You don't necessarily have to go crazy and code out everything in PowerShell, but you need to realize that to be able to be more agile and to be more, your company to be more dynamic and to really get more done, be more productive, and ultimately have your business succeed is to not just accept the work as it is, but think about how is a better way to code this? Is there, okay, I was told that this is the way I need to do it, but that kind of goes back to my personal view of the yes man. I'm not the yes man. I'm the, okay, I'll accept that. But then if I don't think that's right, I'll go back, do my research ahead of time, and then figure out and then propose a better way. Any good company, any good boss would then come to you and say, you know what, that is a better idea. Let's do that. So as far as, you know, that, the read a whole lot on DevOps, the Phoenix Project, and PowerShell especially, and just start changing your view on traditional IT. It's not just physical servers in your data center, or if you're a small company, it's not just physical servers humming and making a data closet, a broom closet 500 degrees like it used to be. You know, look at cloud options and make sure that, you know, it's things are changing from traditional physical servers and physical things that are hard, you can't scale well, to more dynamic culture, to where it's just a workload. Wherever you put the workload, whether it be on premise or whether it be, you know, in the cloud, it doesn't matter. So that definitely is the, if I would sum everything up, just realize that if you're just starting out with coding, if you're a junior developer or a junior admin, definitely just realize that, you know, what you may have learned in college probably would get you a job and get you by, but you really need to start thinking more of a DevOps model.
We've been speaking with Adam Bertram. He is a Microsoft MVP for PowerShell, a coder extraordinaire, and an IT person from the Midwest. Go figure. Adam, we want to thank you for joining us on this episode of Coding 101. It is always a lot of fun when we get to speak with people who, well, even though they come from different places of the country and different backgrounds, they share our love of tech. Could you please tell the folks at home, if they want to find out more about you, about what you do, about the work that you've done, maybe about your GitHub repository, where can they go?
Well, I point everybody to Twitter. I'm AD Bertram. It's down there on the banner there. And I'm also, I blog a lot on AdamTheAutomator.com. So between Twitter and my blog, you'll be able to get links to everything else that I'm working on.
Fantastic. And hopefully Lou will be able to catch you at the MVP Summit, because we'd love to have you back on, especially with Sarah. You made a great team. At one point, I wanted to bring you in to the episode so that you could be the other person doing PowerShell. I mean, she would have a problem on the episode. You would come up with it in the chat room. In fact, Lou, what do you think about having both of them on?
Yeah, I'm down with that, man. I'm going to go grab them out of their summit.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. Now, Lou, of course, we want to thank you too, because we don't have Coding 101 without you. You are the coding brain, and they can find you at Microsoft. We know that. You are with CRM Dynamics. But where else can they find the wonderful world of Maresca?
Well, just like Adam, you can always find me on Twitter at LouMM. And then, of course, all the work that I do at Dynamics CRM is found at that crm.dynamics.com.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for this action-packed episode of Coding 101. I believe we are getting back into a coding module next week. So it'll be a while before our next wild card episode. But if we can, we will try to bring you at least a little something-something from the MVP Summit. Hopefully a full episode. Who knows? Also, thanks to everyone at the studio who makes this show possible. You people are fantastic. Lisa and Leo for letting us do Coding 101. To my TD today, who is... I think Anthony. Anthony, are you still on the buttons?
Yep.
Yeah. What? Can you hear me? No. What is it that you do here?
Oh, just a little bit of everything. TDing, graphics, editing, you name it.
Don't forget that we do Coding 101 every Monday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. Just go to live.twit.tv. If you watch us live, you might as well jump into the chat room at irc.twit.tv. There you can ask questions, you can give us feedback, and I do pull questions from the chat room. You see that I pull statements, I pull comments. It's a nice way to interact with the hosts. It's an experiment here on Twit TV. Also, don't forget that you can find all of our episodes on twit.tv/code or coding. It's one of those. I'll take you to the same place. If you want to download one of our modules, for example, if you want to see development for an Android app, for an iOS app, why not download the last C# module with Lou Maresca? Or if you want to see what Sarah did with PowerShell, we've got those too. It's a great place to go, and it's a great place to find our show notes when they actually work properly. I'm sorry about that, folks. We're still trying to get that fixed. Again, that's twit.tv, and just go for Coding 101. Also, if you've got a chance, go ahead and follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. It's a great place to find out who we're going to be having on the show and to suggest guests and languages for future modules. It's, you know, if you want to interact with me outside of the Twit TV network and find out what else I do, that's always the best place to go. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester saying thank you for watching Coding 101. And Lou Maresca, how do we end our show?
End of line.